Accession number 30372, Reel 2.
When it came up, I was about 17. And by then, my mother, you see, we weren't eligible for real money because we weren't in the camps. My stepfather was in Russia, so it was quite simple, he got whatever, right? But my mother and I could get money if it was proved that I was damaged by the war. I was either ill or, and I had a TB, and then I was sent to a sanatorium straight after the war by the Jewish agency, I think, for a bit, to Zakopane or somewhere like that. And then later in Italy, before we got to Israel, in Italy, I was sent to Lake Como because I was still not. But after, when I grew up in Israel, I took Israel on as my salvation, and I really owe it being a sort of a normal person, which I think I am. And you know, and I had to prove that we had to prove there was something wrong with me, and if we did that, I couldn't go to the army, and I would not go for it. And by then I was also I had a formed opinion about my attitude to Germany and to Israel and to the Palestinians. I was very political when I was 17. And I really didn't want the money. And I was not going to plan to do what I was supposed to do, to suggest that my heart was affected, I had TB, and then have to be released from the Israeli army and then get some monthly allowance. So I did get, despite myself, a small monthly, I think it was something like £9 a month or something, which was good when I came to London because I had no money, you know. But, you know, it was that. But I didn't have to do anything about it. It just came like that. But I was very politically political about it, and I didn't particularly think that the Israelis should have it unless they share it with the Palestinians, even then. Well, he came from a very Jewish, I can't remember where it was, but of a Jewish quarter of Krakow. I can't remember offhand. I can't remember what it was. And his family, both him and his sister, and I think the mother or the father or all of them, had TB. And he was very ill before the war as a young man. He was always the ill son. Very good looking guy. I really liked that, I must admit. When I was a kid, I used to like walking with him in the street. Very pretty man. And he was in hospital and always ill and in hospitals. And apparently, it must have been in 1940, when the Germans got into Krakow, he was just about to have an operation. And he was in hospital, like dying, yeah? Having to have some of his lungs removed or something. And he escaped from the hospital, got on the train to Russia, and went to Uzbekistan. And in there, and also he had a brother, he was like very healthy, apparently, the only healthy guy. And that's where I think he met them. I mean, it's all mixed up in my mind, but basically I think the two of them got into Uzbekistan. And the brother died. Through dysentery and lack of food, etc. And my dad survived because of the climate. And, you know, because he was such a pleasant man, he managed to find work, and he became, he was part of the of sort of some children's home that they used to have there, and children and Jewish children who were there, and he used to be, I think, part of the kitchen staff or something, and he survived the war there, and then he came back. He was still unwell, but you know, he was always known to be unwell, but he was fine. He had something like a quarter of a lung, but he seemed to be okay. He was a bit breathless, and he looked after himself very well. And he would never have children. This is why I was an only child always. And he would not even adopt me. See, I wasn't even adopted. So I always had this separate identity. My mother, when he married, became Stefania Friedman. I was Eugenia Rosenberg. And I had a separate passport and everything. And I was very aware that I was, like, on my own. I don't think he wanted ever responsibility of anything. He was the child. She used to look after him. I knew and I didn't know about Jewishness. I think I learned about Jewishness in school. I remember because I was thrown out. And he was telling about dirty Jews, about Jews are dirty and how they crucified Christ and the whole thing. He was just telling the story. And I remember getting up and saying, it isn't true. Jews aren't. You see, by then, I knew Mietek, my mother's boyfriend, who was such a lovely man, and I knew he's Jewish, and I was protecting him, and I said, no, Jews aren't dirty. You know, I'm Jewish, I'm not dirty, and my mother has a boyfriend who's Jewish, and he's lovely. And I remember there was an absolute silence, and I was expelled.
For what?
For being Jewish and unruly. And I never went to school again after that. I think it must have been just before we left. Because then my lovely boyfriend of my mother's, who by then they got married, her husband, did some sort of dirty sort of business on a train, on some sort of goods transport of the Polish government or something,
and
just sold. He worked on the railways and he sold, I think, some consignment of some goods with some other guy, and they pocketed the money and they were caught and we had to flee. And then we went on a train. I remember I was back in hiding because they had tickets for, or they managed to get some tickets for themselves, but not for me. So I was actually smuggled out under their chair, and I had to sit again under something quietly. And because I was didn't like motion, I was sick. So there was this, everybody was all upset because it was this smuggled kid was all this sick, and they had to all pretend that they were sick and all that. So there was a whole unpleasantness.
How did you get out of Poland?
We went on the train. We went on the train to Czechoslovakia, to Prague. And I think the Jewish agency helped. They must have, you know, helped. Or maybe when we got to Prague, they helped. And then we were in a hotel. We lived in a hotel for 3 months. And maybe they actually had money to go to Prague. They only bought 2 tickets and they smuggled me. I don't know. And we lived in a hotel for 3 months. And then the Jewish agency paid for us to go to Milan, to Italy. And then we stayed for a year in Milan, because by then, in 48, there was the Israeli-Arab war. And my stepfather, he landed a job as a keeper of some ammunition that was sent to Israel via from the Jewish agency or whatever agencies. So we lived on the outskirts of Milan in this small house surrounded by TNT and other bombs and other stuff, and with a dog who was an Alsatian and was called Dolphy, which was Adolf. which was a fantastic, I mean, that's like amazingly clever dog who was my first best friend.
This ammunition, can you talk more about that?
Oh yeah, it was excellent. What it was, basically it was ammunition for Israel, and it was and big lorries used to bring it, and then after some time the different lorries used to come and pick it up, and it was sent to Israel. And they were just metal boxes with guns and some TNT. I mean, I remember TNT bombs and whatever ammunition there is.
Was Israel formed? Was it before May 48 or after?
No, no, it's 48. It was after 48. No. It was between 48 and 49. You see, it was when we got to Italy. It was the war. It was basically that's where the war in the Israeli-Arab war started, and this was just like an underground. Whatever, yeah, and then it was this big yard, and we were given the dog, and the dog was a German Alsatian, who actually understood German mainly, and then learned a bit of Polish from me, but he used to be in the camps. And he used to be very upset whenever he saw any of us naked.
Why?
And he used to really, really cry because he had a conflict of understanding. Because the only naked people that he saw were Jews in the showers, in the camps. He wasn't German, you know, security dog, I imagine. And suddenly he was working for this family that he, you know, and me, particularly me, he used to go into a complete spasm of whining and scratching and everything whenever I was going to have a bath. You know, he could see me naked. He couldn't bear that. It became like just a normal thing that she used to smack me really badly every day because I was unruly. And it became a pattern till I was 17 when I said, you know, if you ever touch me. She was a difficult woman, very strong-willed, obviously. The war finished her off. Her life just collapsed. She married this lovely man who was uneducated, had no profession. They had absolutely no money. She became a dressmaker. He was, all her expectations were shattered. And she hated Israel. She hated the sand. Was so much sand there. She used to get out of the house. She was such a smart, elegant woman. And she was so European. And she didn't like, I mean, I have to say that, she didn't like Jews. She didn't like the mentality, the Jewish mentality. And then she realized that my father, she didn't see his goodness and his niceness. All she could see that he was a simpleton, he was uneducated, he wasn't refined, he had very simple Jewish tastes. He wanted to bring her to that sort of, he wanted a chicken soup. He wasn't religious by all means. It was nothing to do with religion. It was more to do with a heritage. And I didn't like her for that. But I also very quickly realized that I didn't like her values either. And the moment I realized she didn't like Israel, I didn't like her. She had an uncle who survived the war. And a lot of the money that was left and could have been traced was with him. This is one thing I remember, you see, because that affected my life a lot. And after the war, she went to see him. And he told her that there's no money left. And she knew that he's lying. And she was too proud to pursue it. And we ended up with absolutely no money. So when we went to Israel, we ended up in the city of tents. And we lived for, you know, it was called Beit Olim. I don't know how it's. And we lived for 3 or 4 months. We lived in tents, in communal tents. And I learned about life there. I learned about people there. Because by then I was 9. And in those communal tents, I saw more of life than I have ever seen since. And people's relationships and people's life and the worst and the best.
Can you give some examples?
Well, how bad can I go?
As bad as you like.
Okay. I remember having showers with women who had prolapses reaching the floor. I remember people having sex, with their husbands in the front and the husband of the other woman from the back. I remember horrible, horrible things, but I also remember tremendous compassion when you were hungry, people and a child, people always giving you food. We flew from Prague to Italy, but from Italy to Israel we went on a boat. I had a horrible journey because, again, I was sick all the time, absolutely sick. And my parents just couldn't bear it. But there was a guy that was in a cabin next to us who was a Jew from Shanghai. And he used to stay with me and look after me while they were up on the deck dancing or whatever they were doing. And he used to tell me story about Shanghai, and I developed this total sort of interest, romantic sort of notion about Shanghai, which sort of surfaced only a couple of fuckers since, you know, the last year, actually. Well, he used to tell me about the Jewish life in Shanghai. Of the Jews, and about how they were Chinese and what they used to eat and how, about the streets and about their heritage and about everything. I don't remember much, but I just remember being able to cope with my sort of discomfort and my being so unwell through those stories. When we got to Israel, the first thing I remember is that they could not register me because I didn't have a Hebrew name. And I remember first conscious conflict with my mother because the woman said when we were passing by the line, she asked me, "What's your name?" And I said, "Eugenia Rosenberg." And she said, what is your Hebrew name? And I remember looking at my mother, really confused. And she said, she's Eugenia. She hasn't got another name. That's her name. And then the woman said to her, I remember that, it's difficult to write it in Hebrew. It's not a Hebrew name. And my mother said, well, that's what her name is. And then the woman said to me, okay, I'll name you. And your name will be Eugenia, and it will be with Ein, which I didn't know what it means. And it means anchor, and God's anchor, like a boat anchor. And I became Eugenia, and I can tell you, I hated that name as long. I still don't like when people call me Eugenia.
Rosenberg.
Really don't.
Pardon? Did they keep Rosenberg?
Yeah, Rosenberg was fine. You only had to change it later if you work in the Foreign Office or somewhere. You did. This is what I picked up. I suppose I picked up Romanian and Hungarian and Yiddish and Bulgarian, and you pick up words. And I think the milkman that I was very fond of and spent some time with when we over the 3 months when we were there, I think he was Bulgarian. So, you know, I learned words. My stepfather, he immediately found a job in the kitchen. He just did, and he immediately went and found a job in the kitchen. So we had quite good food while we were in the tent city, and my mother used to go into town. She by then became a dressmaker, because that's all she could do. And she used to go to town. She knew some people. There were some old friends from Poland, and she used to try to find a place. We had absolutely no money. The whole thing was difficult. She tried to get some, to get ahead through contacts, make some contacts and things, and she knew them, but it all was very difficult. And the main thing was that nothing was ever good enough for her. She basically was totally out of her depths, unfortunately.
So when she went to town, which town?
Well, I suppose we were in Rehovot, so she used to go to Tel Aviv, or, yeah, wherever. And she used to go into people's homes, and she used to make dresses for them in their home. She didn't have a sewing machine, so she used to go there and do it. And then we were supposed to wait to be allocated a flat in the sort of similar to councils, was called the shikun. But they were not in Tel Aviv. They were in suburbs. And my mother just wouldn't hear of it. She would not go and live in a new town development. And I think that's where her negativeness about Israel started. And then, so we ended up in a one room, sharing a kitchen and bathroom and thing in Jaffa. And those horrible circumstances. I mean, And by then, I have been to a Israeli village, the tents were in a small town in Israel, around orchards with people who lived in villages and near a kibbutz or something. And I tasted it, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I loved the people, I loved the freedom, I loved the clothes, and suddenly I used to run barefoot and everything, and she just hated what's happening to me. And I was like, she kept on losing control, and she also wasn't around as well. And when we were, so there were 3 months that for me was the liberation. So when you talk to me about liberation, for me it wasn't the liberation of Europe, it was my liberation when I got to Israel.
Can you tell me more about the tent city and what you learned?
Yeah, I learned about betrayal. People used to betray each other. Couples. I knew that when you kiss somebody else's wife or husband, there's something wrong with it. I knew that when people were away, other people seemed to get together. I've learned about sex. I've learned about periods. I've learned about men behaving badly, and about drunkenness, about rows, horrible rows, about meanness. But I also learned about betrayal, because my stepfather, who, as I said, is this good-looking man, obviously was a catch. He was very nice. And there was this woman that worked in the kitchens with him. And I suddenly realized that they kept on disappearing into her tent or wherever she was, or I can't remember exactly. While my mother was out. And I must admit, the same protective feeling that I had about my dad, trying to protect him from finding out that my mother slept with my stepfather in Poland when I was much, I actually transferred to my mother or to my stepfather. I don't know who I was protecting, but I used to follow him, and I used to then run back to the bus stop and make sure that if my mother came early or something, I will delay her. And I used to have this role where I felt that I have to make sure that things don't get worse. I was very knowing. I don't think I was innocent. I don't ever remember being innocent. I think I was, you see, in the hiding, I was, you know, I remember that when the three women, they used to laugh, they used to talk and laugh. And often I remember thinking there was something mysterious about some of the laughs than others. You know, there were some words that I picked up, you know, which I thought they sounded naughty. And I think that I also listened to the stories, I understood them, I interpreted them my way. And then later, after the war, of, you know, when we moved to the flat and there were all these men around when my mother and the two women used to go out and disappear and I was left alone, I knew what they're up to in child's way. I didn't know exactly, but I knew that they're doing things grown-ups do. The circumstances were difficult. I knew about my parents' sexuality a lot, because we lived in one room since I was about nine till I was 13. And we lived in it, she worked in it, we slept in it with like an ironing board between us. And I heard their sexual intercourse and I heard what they say. I could see how they do it. I, you know, once caught them in the afternoon, you know, having sex. I mean, yeah, but it was never talked about. My mother didn't speak Hebrew, and I used to read the sex books, and she asked me with some friends with red faces and everything. And when she asked me what it is, I said, we're doing history lessons. I mean, come on, you know. It's a typical immigrant child. You know, in Israel, I had a very similar childhood to a lot of children now in all over the world through multiculturalism. You know, I was an immigrant child. I mean, I wouldn't speak to my parents in the street Polish in case somebody, you know, I tried to pretend they had nothing to do with me. When we moved to this to Jaffa, to Jaffa, and there was a local school. And I was nine, and I didn't speak Hebrew, so I was put in a class of all children who just arrived, and who didn't speak Hebrew. And there was a big contingency of Romanian 16-year-olds who, you know, taught me the rest of what I did know from the camp, from the tent city, I've learned there. And we were just, you know, just being taught Hebrew. But I then realized that there were some other classes. And I thought that really I didn't want to be in this class. So I stopped going to the school and I said, I want to learn Hebrew at home. And my stepfather came to the rescue as usual. He met by pure coincidence one of the children that he used to look after in Uzbekistan in the street, and who spoke Hebrew, because he, you know, this was a Hebrew, like a home, a Jewish home that the children learned Hebrew, and but had no money and no, so he used to come to us every day for lunch, and in return he used to teach me Hebrew.